You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of July 6th, 2022, and we finally escaped the room. We're back.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Alboard.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. And after a little break in which we actually went outside, we're back inside where we belong.
We Summer began and then immediately ended.
Playing video games. We had a little vacation, guests coming in and out of town, but, you know, I don't know if you know this, George, but that light coming from the sun, that's nuclear radiation, all right? Like, you've got to stay inside.
I feel like I'm pretty good. In terms of my overall hours in the sun, I'm sure that there are people that are, like, half my age who've already spent so much time tanning that they've literally been under the sun's rays more than I have my entire life.
That's what I'm saying. It is like, I was reading this thread about someone who was making an argument that the sun is the closest we have to an elder god in our world because it's like this huge thing
that's mutating us.
Yeah, exactly. Live. It has a beginning and an end, but it's so incomprehensible that it might as well be infinite. If you look at it directly, it will blind you like an elder god.
I like that quite a bit. Yeah, some have been driven mad by the sun, I'm sure.
It will literally bake you. So I mean, this is as closest as we can get. Anyway, the point is, we're back, we're playing video games, and we're going to talk about some of those video games now that we've been playing in this kind of early summer wing that we're in.
Yeah. So we got a game that you've just been playing, a couple of games I've just been playing, and then one we've both been playing. Why don't we start with the oldest one?
Okay.
Live Alive.
Live Alive.
What a Japanese name.
Oh, yeah. You know? Oh, yeah.
You just love it. I looked at the key art, by the way, for this game. I see a cowboy, a ninja, a Tarzan baby, a round robot, and at least three weebs.
Yes, there is an Edo Japan dude. There is a like Imperial China guy. Yeah, I mean, and there's like a, there's kind of like a modern, almost like Double Dragon street fighting dude.
That's what he is. Okay.
This was one of those games announced at one of the recent Nintendo Directs, and it's a remake of a 1994 JRPG that never came out in the U.S.
Get your Wayback Machine.
Yeah. And this is just kind of like catnip to me because it brings me back to that time in my life when I was like, oh, man, like, you know, we're never going to get Legend of Zelda Ocarina Gaiden because it's only on the Japanese 64DD, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, I was just obsessed with, like, oh, shit, there's games out there that we can't play. Like, I thought, that was so alluring to me. And so the moment I realized that, like, oh, shit, this is a 1990s JRPG that is just now being localized, like, I'm 100% going to play this. I started playing it. They're doing one of those things that Nintendo has been doing recently, which is they put out the demo, and then the demo just carries over into the full game when it gets released. And so by the time you've made enough progress, you know, the game's going to be out, like, I forget, like next week or the week after or something like that.
Cool. So this is just a classic JRPG then?
Kind of. There's some different tweaks to it. One of the funniest things, by the way, like the title itself, first off, I've played the game for a few hours. I still have no clue why it's called that.
Live Alive. Okay.
And it, apparently, according to the Nintendo Direct trailers, it is, you pronounce it Live Alive.
Oh, Live Alive.
Live Alive, which itself was the subject of much debate over the years because it had never been localized, and so it had never been spoken out loud in the U.S.
Oh, that's so funny. I saw that the title in English also has the second live backwards.
Yes.
So it's Live Leville, really.
Yeah, yeah, with like the weird red A in the middle. Like it's just,
I guess it's flipped either way, but it's not truly, like, you know, reversible.
Yes, it's it's a strange, again, the title's significance is yet to be explained.
Why is there a robot named Cube who is clearly a fucking sphere? It's so infuriating.
So that itself is like, I'm playing through that scenario now. So the way that the game is structured is there are those, all of those playable characters are existing at different points in time. And then my understanding is that at some point in the game, the stories converge and start to, you know, somehow start to interact with each other.
I mean, that's pretty cool. That's, you know, Chrono Trigger-ish.
Honestly, like, that was the thing. I was like, and I mean, I know it's so stupid to get my hopes up because, like, Chrono Trigger is just such a outstanding game in, like, the literal sense, you know? Like, it's just so different from everything. And I was like, man, I'm getting, like, slight Chrono Trigger vibes from this trailer. It's like, what kind of wild scenario has both a, you know, a robot and a caveman, and like that is, it's like literally the Chrono Trigger scenario. And so I wanted to play it just to kind of see how it is and see what they did to it as well, because it's one
of those. Also Clint Eastwood.
I mean, it's just like, there are just straight up, there's just so many weird references and aesthetic choices. They also gave it the treatment of Octopath Traveler. So if you look at the original footage of the game, it looks a lot different. And honestly, like, it looks very rudimentary. Like, you wouldn't think that that game came out in, you know, 94, because there are concurrent games, you know, like Chrono Trigger, that are just way more sophisticated looking. And so they gave it a lot of updating treatment, you know, to when they brought out the Switch version here. Which is cool. I mean, I think that art style, it's a lot. Like, it's kind of like eating a cake with, like, an inch of icing. Like, delicious, yes, but, like, so much, you know?
You,
like,
can't have much of it.
Yeah. But, you know, I like the look. And I also just like the kind of, you know, the general art style as well. You know, there's kind of a cool look to it. But, yeah, I've played through a couple scenarios so far.
How long is each one? Because there's so many characters, I feel like it would become...
I don't know, because some of the chapters I have not been able to fully finish in the demo yet. Like, you get to a certain point in the demo, and even in the chapters, they're like, hey, the rest of this is going to be in the full game, but you could play these other two timelines up into a point, you know? So we'll see how the convergence starts to happen.
Interesting. Yeah, because there's eight different characters. It just seems like that would be a lot. I mean, even if you imagine each of them only taking an hour, you know, you're still talking about 7 hours of playing other characters before you go back to the one that you started with. You know, to really, like, understand how they meld together. But that's cool. I mean, I dig the idea, right? Like, it is instantly interesting. My one concern with any game like this, though, is it really good? Otherwise, why would they not have brought it over? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it came out... I imagine 1994 was a weird time for localizing games, because, like, at that point, you know, Sony was full steam ahead on PlayStation stuff. Nintendo was starting to shift focus to the N64. Like, you know, it wasn't quite clear what the relationship between Sony and, or sorry, Nintendo and Squaresoft was at that point, because this is a Square game. And so I don't know what it's weird. It just feels like, and also my understanding is that this game was not super successful in Japan. It was kind of a cult, you know, it had a cult following, but it wasn't, it was not a Final Fantasy scale success. And so they're like, well, and I think this game came out around the same time as Final Fantasy VI, which is considered like a watershed moment in JRPG-ness. And so,
right. So they were just like, bury it.
Exactly. They were like, well, we tried it, but, you know, we're just going to make Final Fantasies for the rest of time now, you know, like, so, I mean, I just think it came out at a weird time and place. And
imagine a version of the world that, like, this was the thing that struck gold.
I mean, it's, again, you know, referencing Chrono Trigger, like, Chrono Trigger was a similar thing, like, late in the SNES life cycle, post Final Fantasy VI. I mean, I guess it got Chrono Cross, but that's almost its, you know, that's its own thing, really. You know, it's just kind of weird. There were these one-off RPGs in the era before Final Fantasy just, like, steamrolled everything, you know, and Squaresoft decided that they were just, you know, we're just going to make Final Fantasies all day, you know, and here we are. I will say, like, the combat is kind of interesting, where it's a combination It's more like a tactics game where you go into a battle and you go into like a battle screen as if you were, you know, kind of like Final Fantasy, but it's tile based. And so if you move on a tile, basically time progresses and your meter is filling up, but your meter is filling up every time an action happens. So it is a, it is more like a strategy game versus a, like, we're going to wait a timed amount, like, you know, a number of seconds before your abilities recharge. It's like,
right. So when your meter fills, that's when you can take like an offensive action or a spell or something.
Exactly. Yeah. But if you move, you know, your meter, you know, your ability, or sorry, your action meter fills, but so does the enemy. And so you're like, well, I could move and get closer because, you know, this ability, its reach is only two tiles, or I could use a slightly weaker attack and reach this enemy before that enemy can attack. But if I take a step, I'll have a better attack, but also the enemy will now be able to attack, you know? So there's some kind of like give and take of like what makes the most sense. I don't have a full grasp on it yet because there's, in the classic form, there's just like a shit ton of status effects and like all that shit, you know, like, you know, what does anger mean? All of that.
But does it differ at all based upon which character you're playing as?
So far the abilities have been slightly different, but, the system itself, I think, is
same idea.
Is going to be the kind of tile based tactics system. But I'm going to stick with it. I'll see how far I get with the full game. I fell off of, in a weird way, it makes me understand Octopath Traveler more. Because Octopath was clearly inspired by this, you know, like the Octopath was eight characters. You can play them in any order, but they all start to converge. And this is it. But it was just made in 94, you know, so like it all of a sudden makes Octopath more, it makes more sense in retrospect. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
It's been a while since I played an RPG. So if it's good, maybe I can put the fact that there's a fucking sphere named Cube behind me.
So they've already. So I started playing through that scenario last night, and the character who names that little robot Cube
is a troll.
Yeah, he does it as a joke. He's like, "This is a terrible joke," and he does it. And I was like, "Well, I mean, I guess at least they're commenting on it."
I mean, fair enough. That's why the robot should like fight back. You know,
I wonder. Maybe that's the end of that scenario. Cube goes rogue. He
kills him for sure.
What's on? What's been on your list?
Okay, so a game that I recently finished, two games really, but I'm going to talk about them in the same sort of space. No. One is We Were Here Forever, and another is Escape Simulator. So We Were Here Forever is, I think it's the fourth or fifth entry into the We Were Here series, which is a indie game series that is specifically a two-player co-op game that is a sequence of puzzles, a lot like an escape room.
Okay.
So let's say, as one example, one of the puzzles in this We Were Here game, you are underwater. One person is underwater. The other person is out of water, but needs to redirect breathing tubes for them to find and breathe as they progress through this puzzle.
Was this like co-op Saw the game? Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, here? I mean, yeah. That's exactly right. Co-op Saw the game is a great way of putting it, because essentially, It is a co-op game where it frequently separates each of the players and then gives each of the other players a piece of the overall puzzle so that you have to communicate in order to solve the puzzle.
Right.
These games have never been great, is the honest truth about it. I've played every single one, and I finished this one. They've never been very good. They're all, though, there's always something interesting. And there's a couple of puzzles that are really cool or really kind of clever, right? Like, there was one puzzle in which, it's difficult to describe, but imagine being on the inside of a ball made of hexagonal tiles.
And it's like a Dyson sphere.
Yeah, but you're on the inside, and each of the different hexagons connect, and I can see my ally. So I could see you above me, but then you could go through a portal that would put you in a different cube, and the two cubes connect, and you need to like move levers to move the other person's cube. So it's a complicated, weird dance of you being like, oh, well, in your room, do you see X? And you sort of have to describe to someone and imagine how their world looks so that you can get a sense of what you need to do in your world to affect theirs.
Interesting.
What I will say to this game's credit is that there's just not a ton of games like this. Like, we just don't have a lot of co-op games that are truly built for co-op.
Right.
And having asymmetric information is one of the key ways that you can create, I think, a very cool co-op experience that really encourages you to communicate with one another. The co-op game that everyone was shooting their bricks over a couple years ago that you and I were like meh about.
I was just going to ask, does this game have a somewhat suspect racist book that gives you love advice?
Oh, God, I wish. No, it does not. Unfortunately, it does not. And
it takes it two is what we're talking
about. It takes two, yeah. I mean, it's similar in that vein, right? In that, you know, there's a... It's not as action-y as that game. It's much more about the individual puzzles. But it that same idea, right, where you will separate one another and each of you will have your own ways of interacting with the world. And which path you go kind of depends on which character you play as or which, you know, which door that you open. And there's a story that goes on that is sort of somewhat there throughout. But for the most part, it's all about the puzzles. And like any classic puzzle game, it's hit and miss, right? But I was looking into, well, you know, what are the games like this? I want to play more co-op games that are sort of puzzle co-op games. And so I was doing some research and there's just not very many of them. There's a few that are horror specific that I was like, okay, well, maybe I could get into that. The one that I did get into and was making me optimistic was Escape Simulator. So Escape Simulator is a game that came out, I think, quite recently, just this maybe past month or so. That is an escape room game. And you and I have played escape rooms in the past.
Yeah.
Mileage varies, right? Sometimes they're fun, sometimes they're not. Generally speaking, I think the best ones lean into that cooperative experience, right? Where, like, so for example, I did a co-op escape room game that was took place in a jail. Mm. And one couple was in one jail cell and one couple was in another jail cell. And we needed to like pass things back and forth to one another.
Oh, yeah.
In real life, mind you, to like solve our puzzles together.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that experience. It was not a great venue, but it was a cool idea, right? Of separating these two groups.
Yeah.
And so, like, to me, that's kind of what I'm always looking for. What is that, you know, what is that sort of casual co-op experience that isn't a shooter that could be a compelling one?
Yeah.
So, We Were Here Forever. Interesting. It's fine. If you're looking for that experience, I could strongly recommend the We Were Here series. And every game is just a continuation of that same idea. So if you like the first one, I think there's a free demo of any of these. If you like it, you can just keep playing it and you're going to get more of it. So fine. Escape Simulator is interesting because the game comes with a set of rooms made by the designers, but pretty much universally, I think that they're all not very good. They're because they don't lean into the co-op side of it really at all. And they're very small. Like, I think you can fit four players solving a puzzle in any given time, but it's a squeeze with two people walking around the room and trying to solve a puzzle, let alone four. Some awesome quality of life things, but the coolest thing is that it is open to community design and people are making a bunch of escape rooms from the community.
Wow.
They made the pick for June, the top pick for June was a Bo Burnham themed inside escape room.
That's great.
That you can escape from the room that he is in his series.
Inside. Yeah.
Yeah. I played a popular one that was Star Wars themed that had like pictures of Darth Vader on like Disney rides, like all the memes and stuff. It was like a comedy one and it was extremely challenging. But it's really neat to see the community sort of get together and sort of fill that niche by creating escape games.
So it's just like, is it like a logic? Did they have like a whole like logic engine behind it? And like,
it's pretty bare bones. So basically, there's text that can give you clues, and then you can upload your own images, and everything is an item that you can navigate in three dimensions. So I don't know how you make your asset, but you could ostensibly just come up with like an image, attach it to a cube and then put that cube in the room and someone could pick up that cube and then navigate around it. There's like lock and keys. So I think like any simulator game, they've given designers, you know, the absolutely bare bones necessary elements to produce an escape room experience. What I can say is from playing a few community levels, it's all there. Like I don't really know what they're missing other than assets or textures that you might otherwise have in a normal escape game.
I think they're missing the fact that we're being forced to hang out with our coworkers in an escape the room game.
That's probably fair. Yeah. You know what the best, I don't know, I'd be curious how many you've done, but like the best escape room, was actually made by some like old high school friends. So in Sebastopol, California, there's, I don't know, it probably doesn't exist anymore after COVID for many reasons.
Yeah.
But it was a time travel themed one. And at one point you had to solve puzzles in a small room. Mm. And while you were in there, they went into the previous room because the small room was a time machine. And when you came in, they reset everything and replaced it to like have earlier versions so that you traveled back in time. That was pretty fucking cool.
That's cool. That's, yeah, I don't know. I did one, again, I feel like this has become a like corporate mainstay or whatever, but like, again, pre-pandemic, I did one that was something similar happened where they kind of reset the original room, but with tweaks that, and I thought that was clever.
Yeah, that's cool.
But yeah, well, that's cool. I'm still interested in how they set every, like, you know, how do they build out their game engine such that like, okay, if the player touches this, then this panel opens up, you know, like I find that stuff really impressive to like have all that weird background logic set up.
Yeah. There's a few other escape simulators like this, like another escape game like this that I actually tried that is really not good for those reasons. Like it just is really super fucking janky.
Yeah.
And you can tell that even the community making it struggled with that. Right. I think this one is far more elegant. It's childish. Like, it feels like a Balloon House escape game in a way. Like, but it's cool. And there's some cool themes to that. So I think if you were into co-op puzzle games, We Were Here Forever, Escape Simulator, worth your interest, I think that there's a severe lack of games like this. And it's shocking to me how few there are.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So speaking of puzzle games, maybe we shift gears into a wholly different type of puzzle game.
Yeah, Neon White.
Neon White. I told you, I was telling you this over text message, but I had no idea what this game was. I only had heard good buzz about it. And so I was like, I'm going to make it rain. I'm going to spend $25 blind on the Nintendo eShop. And so I just bought it. And then I realized what sort of game it was. And I was like, I've made a huge mistake.
I did the same thing. Well, I didn't do the same thing. I was playing on Steam as well with a gamepad.
Yeah.
And then I found a particular puzzle where I realized I knew what I had to do. And I needed accuracy that the gamepad would just never provide.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just
I went back and got it on PC, by the way, just for
smart. Yeah. I noticed because I saw your records pop up on the thing. So for listeners, this game is, how would you describe this? Actually, you know what? The best way that I described it, I think, is it's kind of like the Mirror's Edge time trial challenges.
Yeah.
Because it's all about movement using this sort of card system and explosives and moving around the map at the end of the day. Yeah. It is kind of a shooter because there's like guns in it, but it's really just a running game.
Yeah, it's a first, I would consider it like a first person time trials game, you know, where you're trying to get through these levels and there's some things that you do, you know, there's some enemies or obstacles that you need to, you know, you need to break down this door. So you do need to shoot it or whatever. But the point is to actually get from point A to point B as quickly as possible. And it's timing you down to the, you know, 10,000th of a second or whatever. And, and you're like, you have boards and everything.
Right, so you have to kill all of the demons in a level to get out of the level.
Yeah.
And then you just have to escape. Those are the only limitations.
Yeah.
Which means that even though that it is designed to say, you know, use their card system, which means each weapon is a card. If you run out of ammo, you lose the card. But you can also expel the card for some special movement ability.
Yeah.
So the sniper rifle lets you dash forward. The yellow pistol allows you to jump. Mm-hmm. A few of the others will like drop a bomb and let you bounce off the bomb or slam down, so on and so forth.
And you can only carry, I forget what it is. Is it three cards or something at a time?
You can only carry two different cards and you can only carry a maximum of three cards per type.
Yeah. So it's not like you can like build up your arsenal to have like all of the abilities. Like there's definitely levels where I was like, oh, cool. Like if I miss this card, I'm screwed. Like I needed to get this in order to traverse, you know, it's not a thing where like, you know, you can either hoard them or avoid them. Like you usually do need to use them intelligently.
Yes. But what's great is it kind of tricks you because it sets around the map in a way that is really fluid for you to understand, right?
Yeah.
You move forward, you see a yellow card, you use that yellow card. In the process of using the yellow card, you touch a purple card. Now you use the purple card.
Yeah.
So it teaches you this very specific way of here's how you execute through the map. And it's relatively clear. So by the time that you do your first run, it maybe it takes you like a minute or something, but you get it, right? You fully understand it.
Yeah.
I think where the game really shines is where you break it and you try to cut off and shave time off of your runs.
Yeah.
Because you can quickly realize, well, look, the only limitation is I have to kill all of the demons. It doesn't tell me what order I need to do that in. It doesn't tell me what weapons I need to do it in, right? Like, I think one of the ones that I felt like the coolest about was there are two enemies that you, when you touch them, you pop up into the air.
Yeah.
And it's used in the normal path as a way of getting up higher. But you could also just shoot them from a fucking mile away with a sniper rifle and never go over there.
Yeah.
And you can shave off like 5 seconds of your run.
Yeah.
And that like push to be clever about it and think about where you can save time, it feels really good. And it reminds me how challenging it actually is to create that speed run fantasy. Like from a design perspective, I think it's really challenging because games like these are very easily frustrating.
Yeah.
But I don't know how you feel, but I'm really enjoying the minute-to-minute gameplay. I don't feel like it's very frustrating at all. And I'm genuinely enthused to replay level and shave off like milliseconds. These are one of those games where I'm trying to beat people that I don't even know on my Steam's friend list because I know that they did it and I think I could do it half a second faster.
Well, I think to your point, the game is really good at giving me a window into what people who actually do speedruns, why they like it. Kind of in a similar way as to, I don't know, I'm trying to think of like an analog where, you know, this game kind of teaches you, you know, how speedrunners must approach something, which is like, first off, you just play the level, like get through the level, understand the level, like, okay, here's where the items are, here's where the enemies are, I'm going to get through it. And then I'm going to try to do it this way. Oh, maybe I can actually just jump over this entire section instead of walking over it. Okay, interesting. It's like, oh, maybe I don't need this gun, or maybe I don't need to, you know, take that path. And this game is just really elegant in giving you those breadcrumbs, whereas a true speedrunner does it because, you know, they're doing it, but they're not incentivized by the game to do it. They're like, hey, maybe in the Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time, if I backflip through this wall, I can like, and it's like, oh man, like that is super impressive. I probably will never be able to do that. But this game, you know, it forces you to do the level once. And then the more you do the level, it starts to unlock hints where it's like, oh, like, have you tried going this way? And it's like, oh shit. Like,
yeah,
that would shave off like 3 seconds of my time. I didn't even think about it. And so like, it gives you, you know, it kind of gives you bumpers to be like, oh, you know, this is, you know, you've kind of put in your work. Now let me give you a nudge as to like what you could do next or not, or just go to the next level, whatever, you know. Yeah.
It'll give you clues as well. So as long as you make some kind of progress, you will unlock the ability to see like a single hovering hand, which gives you a sense of how you might achieve that. The thing that I actually like the most, every level has a gift that you can find, which is basically just an Easter egg floating around in the level that you need to be clever in order to get. And that itself is a puzzle as well. Like, you know, there are times very frequently where I will go into it with the intent of finding the gift. And as a result, I'm spending time looking at the map. I'm analyzing, okay, well, how do I get that high? Or what enemies do I need to defeat? And what cards do I need to have in my pocket at this moment to get to that location?
Yep.
And as a result of 3D mapping the environment and poking around, I see, I think I can shave off a full second by using taking this path. Or I now understand that, like, oh, if I'm actually fluid with this, I can make this jump and really be efficient with my time.
Yep.
And then kick me back into the game to then try to once again beat my record. I think it's a really elegant solution of giving players a reason to slow down, look at the map, and analyze it from like a navigation perspective, and then allow it to click naturally. The idea of like, oh, you know, now that I've given this attention, I could see how I can use this to my advantage. I think that's really, really smart, because otherwise I would just get the best time that I thought I could and leave and not actually think about it from like a third person perspective.
Yep. And for the folks that, it's just elegant, you know, for folks that are not necessarily going to play each level, you know, 20 times or whatever, the presence and the secret items in the levels themselves are like, okay, maybe you just care more about the platforming than the speed running. Great. Here's a whole thing for you. You know, like it's just, It's just a really clever way of designing a game that teaches you a little bit what that community probably finds valuable and rewarding. And, you know, I've never gotten into... there are some games like that where there's like Trackmania or Trials or, any of those games where it's like, I get it. Like, academically, I understand why people find those games satisfying, but I've never gotten into them because, you know... the learning curve is really steep and, you know, you're not going to get like a helpful hint in Trials or whatever, or Trackmania, but like, this is very similar. It's just a little bit more meant for a broader audience, in a good way. And I've been enjoying it quite a bit. There's also just this huge narrative around it, which is hilarious that we haven't talked about.
I was going to next because here's my one issue with the game. The narrative is absolute fucking trash. I think every single moment that I spend in the narrative, it is overly written, unfunny, like badly characterized. There's this relationship mechanic that you get in a lot of games.
It's like a Persona style kind of social like link.
The gifts that you find in the world, you can give to people.
Yeah.
But they clearly worked so little on it. Like, every gift is the same. It tells you nothing about the characters. Like, it is completely uninspired, absolutely tedious trash. And I use strong words because I really want to convey how useless I think that the narrative is for this experience. And I'm really liking the gameplay. And man, I just wish... you didn't have to have it. Like, can we just like have a shorter, tighter game and just jettison the story entirely?
I'm like sickly fascinated by it. I agree with you where it's like, it's a lot in the same way that the, you know, my cake icing, you know, it's a lot, you know, like it is, it's anime to the extreme. It is someone who, I mean, honestly, probably like you or me who were like, staying up late to watch anime in the 90s in their local PBS stations because that's the only way we could get it. You know, like it feels like it was made by those types of people who, instead of kind of pulling the ripcord and getting a little bit less obsessed with anime, they doubled down.
Yeah, there's just a lot of like, are you looking at my breasts and like weird like sexual stuff?
Yeah.
And like, it is just... But and then even the drama of it, of like, you're in heaven, but there's like a cool cat boss that is your heavenly agent. Like, it just, none of it works for me at all. And at this point, I'm just fast. What's so dumb, too, is I love getting the gifts because that's such a cool puzzle.
Yeah.
And then I feel obligated to give the gifts. And I'm like, well, maybe this is where it'll get serious and be cool. But it's not. Like, it's completely not. I've never given a gift and felt like that was worth the effort it took for me to get that gift.
Yeah. Yeah. It was never a... it was never like a Persona like payoff of like, oh, cool, I'm glad I did spend time with Chie this afternoon.
You know? Dude. I mean, yes, because I would look, I miss Chie, dude. I love those games. I would love, wedding those two, Boyfriend Dungeon. Like, I'm always chasing that. You know, I want the Persona layer on top of my compelling experience. In fact, Persona often has the opposite problem where some of the gameplay dungeons are absolutely awful and tedious. And you're just going through it because you want to get to the story elements, right?
Yeah.
I'm always looking for that marriage. This is the perfect example of the exact opposite swing, where I think the gameplay is truly fantastic and the story is just absolute D-tier.
And it's weird. I've listened to some people on podcasts talk about it and it's divisive. You know, some people are like...
Some people love it.
Yeah, some people think it's funny. And some people think like, oh, like this is so over the top that I'm kind of on board. And for me, I'm just like... It's a lot, like, but I am sickly fascinated by it, but just almost like in a train wreck type way where it's like, man, like how far are they going to go with this? You know,
and the humor is so easy though. Like it's not even self-referential enough.
I mean, there's some things, you know, like when your dude, I mean, who knows, maybe you fast forwarded this by now. Cause it, you know,
that's probably true.
So the cat boss makes a comment on, the cat boss is just like another one of those angels in heaven, and he just takes the form of whatever makes sense to the neons because their human brains can't comprehend the image of a true angel. And so to your bro, like neon yellow, he looks like John Cena.
Yeah.
And so it's like there are some things.
Oh, that's so funny. I didn't catch that.
So yeah, I mean, but which is why like every time I'm tempted to like fast forward something, there is a thing where it's like, man, okay, this stupid meathead bro that is like actually kind of fun to hang out with, like his cat bro looks like John, like straight, they just mentioned John Cena by name. He's like, whoa, John Cena, where'd you get here? And I'm like, okay, that's kind of funny, you know, like that yeah. sort of thing. But so like every time I'm about to jettison it, I'm like, okay, what are they gonna do next thing. You know, it's like the other thing that I will say about just the aesthetics is it reminds me a lot of a Suda game, like Suda 51, you know, Killer 7 or something like that, where like it seems purposefully ugly in the game.
Even the gameplay, even the world itself seems like weirdly sparse.
Yes.
As though they didn't really want to put in the effort to make it look good.
Yeah. You know? It's it seems like the art style or the lack of art style is itself a statement, in the same way that the reason why No More Heroes still looks like that after all these years, you know.
I think that's what's so jarring about the narrative, right? Is because the gameplay is so sleek,
yeah,
right? It's very minimalist and efficient. So yep. To me, it strikes me as an indie game to the extreme. Like, this is something that could just be, you know, if it was just gameplay, a cool tech demo that you play at IndieCade,
yeah,
you know, that you go, oh, I think there's something here,
yeah,
right? But then the story is just overly written and like, you know, way too self-serious, and
it's pretty wild. Did you catch that lead developer is Ben Esposito?
No,
he is the Donut County guy.
That's so weird. These two games are completely different.
Yes.
Donut County is just like a meditative chill game that you don't have to do anything.
Yeah.
Whereas like Neon White is like, you really, it's quite strict in its execution.
Yeah. So it's just kind of funny that like it's, and I did a little bit of reading and some interviews and such with him, but you know, he got interested in the speedrunning community and kind of was inspired.
Oh, really?
By it. Yeah. And this was, you know, this was one of the, this is one of the outputs of that. But again,
I mean, like, I love that story, right? Like the idea that you could look at a whole community and go, I want to capture what makes those people heroic, you know, and what makes it such a compelling experience for them. And I think it's a stellar job. Like I love Neon White. I'm really having a great time playing this game, other than the story.
But it's just, I love seeing the, because he also, I don't think he was like a lead on it, but like he worked on, he worked on What Remains of Edith Finch, and he worked on The Unfinished Swan as well. They're both kind of non-traditional first-person games, you know? Sure. And it's like, oh, okay, there's like something here, you know, that there's an exploration here in like what the perspective does and like what you can do within the perspective. I find it fun when someone whose last work was Donut County swings so far in the other direction to this, you know, it's cool to see that level of range.
I respect people that have the commitment to putting their design chops into various different genres, right? Because it shows a fluency in design as expertise rather than like a particular genre, right?
Whether it's for the narrative or just because I want to see all the levels, like I'm going to keep playing through it just to kind of see what the level design turns into and, see what sort of like other challenges get put into there. So I'm excited to see the rest of it.
I definitely recommend picking a couple levels that you think are cool and trying to just see like how brutal of a speed can you make?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Because when you like unlock it, I mean, I think every room or every challenge, I think, has like one or two shortcuts essentially that are like easier. Like once you get, will help shave the time, and then it's just execution. Mm. And there's a limit. Like I know I'm never going to be on the global leaderboard in the top 10 or something, right? Like I'm never going to be that skilled. But it does feel really good to be, you know, nearing 40 and being able to like, you know, carve out time. Like when I shave time off by like 3 seconds, man, it feels good. I'm like, oh, hell yeah.
I mean, even those little things were like at a certain point, I realized that I forget which gun it is, but one of the discard abilities is like a timed bomb where like you throw it and then I realized that you can throw the bomb and you can actually detonate it faster by slicing it. Like that bomb basically takes 1 second to detonate, which doesn't sound like a lot, but in the context of this game is a huge, that's one huge second, you know? And so like the being able to slice it, to immediately detonate it. It was, and that's when I kind of realized what the game was. And I was like, ah, okay. Like this is the path that it's going down, which is cool. I will never be a very fast player in this, I don't think, but I really respect the level of depth there.
Oh yeah, for sure. Totally agree.
Cool. All right. I think that's it. And we're going to, maybe we'll check in after we see the rest of it. And I can report back on the story of both Live Alive and Neon White.
Yeah.
And see if I can.
I mean, please do. Yeah. I want to know what happens.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I can report back on whether the nonsense of both of those games ever converges on something.
Right. Exactly.
Cool. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website. Do us a favor, find us wherever you find podcasts, leave us a review, and tell a friend.
Cool. All right, everyone. As always, thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao.